Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Kim Wunschmann, a member of the Center for German Jewish Studies at the University of Sussex, here to talk about her new book, Before Auschwitz, Jewish Prisoners in the Pre-War Concentration Camps, published this year by Harvard University Press. Kim, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason. It's really a pleasure to talk to you and to your audience.
Well, it's great to have you. So, Kim, this book is about the pre-war concentration camps. What years are we talking about, and what are the important historical turning points over the course of your narrative? I think that there are three sort of broad phases. Is that right?
That's correct, Jason. Well, the book covers the pre-war years in the history of Nazi Germany, and I look broadly at three phases, as you said. The first one is the phase 1933 to 1934. The second one is the phase roughly 1935 to 1937. And the last one is the phase 1938 to 1939.
And so tell us a little bit about the pre-war concentration camps. How were they similar and how were they different from the wartime camps?
Yes, well, they are very different from the usual image that we have in mind when we think about the concentration camps. Very different from your barrack, classical structure of the camp. They were rather improvised sites found in all sorts of pre-existing structures, like you'd have, for example, disused factories, old breweries, hotels, private apartments, castles. There was even a ship that was turned into a concentration camp. So very much not purpose-built for being concentration camp, but found within existing buildings. Improvisation and the lack of coordination was very much the key feature of those pre-war concentration camps. There wasn't much coordination from the regime. It was in the main local actors that empowered themselves and that made up the rules as they go. And the change only comes at the end of this first phase, 1934, when the SS gradually takes over these various sites and turns them into what we think or what we call the system of the concentration camps. So this first 1.5 years, if you want, between Hitler's assumption of power and the summer of 1934 is a very uncoordinated phase in the history of the camps. It's only then, in the second half of 1934, that the SS takes over and forms the camps into a system that we then have in mind also when we think about the wartime camps. And of course, Auschwitz as the most widely known of those concentration camps, which was set up only in May 1940.
Right, and the individual who's sort of responsible in 1934 for systematizing these camps is who?
As I said, there was no system in 1933-34, so it's local authorities. This could be a local SA leader. This could be also the mayor of a town, a Gauleiter, a police chief. So all sorts of local actors who take the initiative and go forward without national coordination, setting up these very varied places.
Right. So there's a lot of improvisation going on. Mm-hmm. What do we know about the living conditions of the camps and who was sent there?
Yes, it's interesting. If you think about the first association that we have about those early concentration camps, it would mostly be political prisoners, right? Because the first campaign of terror of the regime was directed in the direction of the labor movement and the organized working class, crushing them as a political opposition. So mostly when people try to think about Jews in the early concentration camp, they would come up with the notion that these were probably communists, socialists, social democrats, political activists, which is true, but we'll also find, and this is maybe surprising, a large number of Jews who were interned for what I'd call non-political reason. And this could be ordinary people, for example, merchants, businessmen, cattle dealers, people accused for having friendly or sexual relations with non-Jewish partners, the so-called race defilement accused. So it's a very, very broad variety of Jewish prisoners. But what is clear is that Jews became prisoners of the camps like from the very first month on, from March 1933, when we see the first camps being set up. Jews are found among the prisoners, and they are arrested for various reasons, which we normally wouldn't think, because we kind of like go in the trap of the regime, who, for propaganda purposes, said that these Jews were Marxist insurgents or communist subversives, right, who plotted to overthrow the state. It's only when we drill down really case study by case study to the reasons of why Jews were arrested that we see the broad variety of rationales and reasons behind their arrest and imprisonment.
Right. So the Jews in the camps actually were a very diverse group. What kind of numbers are we talking? And, you know, what did the Nazi regime, how did they deal with the question of who is a Jew?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, first of all, the numbers, again, if we stay in that first phase of the early concentration camps, in general, are very high. We think about 150, maybe even 200,000 people being interned in 1933 alone. So a very, very high number. Now, we don't have concrete figures of how many of these were Jews, but my estimate that I'll come to in the book is that about 5%, so around 10,000 people, were of Jewish roots and Jewish background.
Go ahead.
Remind me of the second part of your question.
Defining who is
yeah.
a Jew.
Defining who is a Jew? Well, I should say that in the book, I had to make this decision. So if I'd look at the persecuted themselves, there were a number among them who wouldn't necessarily define themselves to be Jews. And clearly by, if we go by halakha, by Jewish religious law, also some of them would probably not be counted in within this group. So I had a dilemma of who were actually the subject of my study. And in the end, I decided for going for all those people who were persecuted as Jews. So it's not necessarily their own self-definition, but the regime deciding on them being Jews and persecuted as Jews. And this has to do, as you know, of course, with the Nuremberg racial laws, with the Nazi definition of who is a Jew. But there is a difference between self-determination and enemy perception of the regime.
Mm-hmm. What kind of media coverage did the pre-war camps receive?
Oh, they were very public, very much in the media. Lots of press reports. There was even a radio program on the concentration camp of Oranienburg, close to Berlin. So the regime had a very vital interest in making the camps public as a means of deterrent, of course, first of all. The image that the regime sent about the camps was one of an institution of betterment or a so-called re-education institution. So these were places for German national comrades who went astray or who kind of like needed an education to be let back into the German so-called people's community, which was the utopia social community of that the Nazis envisioned. So the image of the camp was, first of all, very public through reports by the regime, but it was also the talk of town mostly. I mean, people were very much, we know that, talking about the camps, also those people who returned from the camps, the released prisoners, shared their experiences. So it was very much within the public knowledge of German people.
Right. One of the things that I think you really want to try to get people to think about in the book is that this is not a linear process. We go from the pre-war camps and it goes right into the wartime camps as if, you know, it was preordained. Mm-hmm. So in what ways were the pre-war camps a transition phase?
Yes. Again, this was one of the decisions that I had to make for my narrative. Like, do I look at the pre-war camps as most people have done from the perspective of the wartime catastrophe, which then oftentimes leads historians to think that these places or this phase in the concentration camp history was just an antecedent, just a prelude to the later catastrophe. And I quickly found out that I'd had to go for other questions if I didn't want to fall into that trap. So my question really is, what was the role that the concentration camps played within this process of exclusion of Jews from German state and society during the years 1933 to 1939? How were these new sites of terror used also as instruments of kind of violent social engineering, if you want, to forcefully sort all those called community aliens from those who were considered to be valuable national comrades? And for the Jews in Germany, how much were the camps instruments of terror, really, to pressure Jews into emigration? So before a Nazi anti-Jewish policy switched from expulsion to extermination, of course, the camps played a different role. They were used to speed up the forced immigration from Germany. So really, we see that starting already in 1935, a policy evolves that uses a camp to forcefully remove Jews from the Nazi people's community. Gradually, emigration became the only valid condition for release. The only ways for Jews out of the concentration camp led into exile. You could be only released if you'd have your emigration papers ready. So really, I think exploring the camp within that process of exclusion, within that process of forcing Jews to leave Germany, was the main rationale of the book.
Right. And you sort of put yourself in the shoes of some of the Jewish prisoners, right? Mm. Because they couldn't predict what was going to happen in 1940.
Exactly. Yeah. I have this one sentence where I say that basically the final solution of the Holocaust was unthinkable in the 1930s. So I have one of my protagonists, Ludwig Bendix, is a lawyer from Berlin, and he is actually twice interned in the pre-war concentration camp. He is interned in the early camps, I think from summer 1933 to winter 1933. And then again from 1935 to 1937. So clearly he is also an example to investigate Jewish reactions or Jewish resistance through this new instrument of terror, because he's very much, he considers himself to be a German, right? And he is not intimidated by the terror of the camps, doesn't want to leave. And it's only then in 1937, when the Nazis make it the condition for him to be freed from Dachau, that he very, very unwillingly leaves Germany and goes to Palestine. But still in that very last days, he's preparing a legal suit against the commandant of Dachau. And so still believing in the function of law, and only his kids have to stand guard over him and make sure that he never sends off this legal suit. So yeah, I put myself in the perspective of the persecutor to explain to the reader really what kind of a scandal these camps were, and also how hard the Nazis had to try, first of all, to turn this very diverse minority group of German Jews into a homogenous group of enemies. And secondly, what kind of resistance they also encountered from the persecuted.
Why have the pre-war camps receded from history and memory?
Yeah, well, I think it's not so surprising if we think about the sheer scale and the systematic organization of the final solution and of the wartime destruction. I mean, these staggering numbers, this unbelievable dimension of the genocide draws the attention, and it draws the attention both of the public and also of the scholars, of historians, who probably first of all felt the need to bring order in that chaos of the wartime camps and to interpret them. And then, as I said, if you look at the pre-war years and you see them in the same line, then they can only pale into insignificance, because nothing can really compare with this massive scale of destruction. So I think it probably takes a while until you come from other directions, and my direction was more like researching social change within German society rather than Nazi Germany's genocidal policies, that opens a new perspective, or it opens a new view on the pre-war period.
Right. Let's get into the chapters a little mm-hmm. bit. The first chapter is called "In the Beginning There Was Violence," and there are two sort of euphemisms that were interesting. One is protective custody, mm-hmm. and the other is special treatment. Can you tell us what those are and how the use of this, you know, seemingly not so terrible propaganda actually disguised what was really going on?
Yes, protective custody is a crucial term. We can define it as indefinite detention without trial. It's an instrument that comes out of the declaration of a state of emergency, and it actually precedes the Nazi period. It goes all the way back to the mid-19th century, when, in the wake of the failed German Revolution of 1848, the state of Prussia for the first time uses this instrument of protective custody to arrest people for an indefinite period of time, to hold them in custody, allegedly for their own protection. So as you rightly said, it's a very euphemistic term, really. Who is to be protected from whom, and for whom is this a good thing? But we can clearly see that from the beginning, it was an instrument to dominate people and to forgo due legal procedures that are actually necessary. So the tradition of protective custody was there in Germany before, but again, what the Nazis did in exploiting this pre-existing instrument is taking it to an enormous scale. I've talked about the numbers of people in arrest, so tens of thousands really were taken into protective custody. And it was ushered in after the burning of the Berlin Reichstag on the 27th of February 1933, when the regime, this very, very new regime, not even a month old, decided to declare the state of emergency, seemingly to ward off the threat of a communist overthrow. And here we have to go back into the last years of the very troubled Weimar Republic, in which there was almost a civil war going on between communists and right-wing activists, SA stormtroopers, National Socialists, fighting each other in the streets of Berlin and other cities. So this fear of the communist overthrow was very much there, and the Nazis purposely abused the fears of larger circles of the German public, conservative circles, to then declare the state of emergency and make this instrument of protective custody one that could help them to arrest large amounts of people without trial and for an indefinite period of time.
Right. Chapter 2 looks at some of the day-to-day realities in the early concentration camps. Maybe tell us, what is the Jew company?
Right. And I forget to answer your question about the special treatment. So we see that when we look inside the camps, and this is what I do in the second chapter, I shift my perspective until in the inside area of the concentration camps. And we see that a practice of anti-Jewish violence very, very early on emerges. And this is something that the perpetrators refer to as the so-called special treatment, which, of course, again, is a euphemistic term for treating Jewish prisoners in the harshest possible way. So we see that the Jewish prisoner group, although the number might be rather small, assumes a special significance within the day-to-day working of the camps. Somehow it becomes crucial that Jews are there. They quickly turn what I call into the outcasts among the outcasts. So they rank at the very bottom of the prisoner hierarchy, singled out for degrading punitive labor, for public humiliation. And they are segregated into special housing units. And this is something, again, that doesn't happen in a coordinated fashion, but it happens in more and more camps that the guards, also in order to be able to identify Jewish prisoners, develop all sorts of strategies to mark them externally. And one of the convenient things, of course, was to have them all living in the same housing unit, in the same barrack. For example, in the Dachau concentration camp, this starts right at the beginning. Also in the Oranienburg camp close to Berlin, we have a so-called Jew company in which Jews are forced together, everybody who's declared to be a Jew. And again, sometimes this would not correspond to individual self-identification, is housed within the Jew company, which then makes them very visible, very exposed to this so-called special treatment of the guards.
Right. Most of the Jewish prisoners in the early concentration camps were men, mm-hmm. but in chapter 3 we see that there were some interesting differences and also similarities in the experiences of the detention of women. So what can you tell us what's going on in that chapter?
Yes, well, you're right in pointing out that camp imprisonment in the main affected Jewish men. We also have a small minority of Jewish women, I think probably not more than 1,000 of the Jewish prisoners of the pre-war time were women. So I decided to devote a whole chapter to Jewish women and see what were basically the differences and the similarities between them. I should say that maybe one of the striking differences is that there is no documented case of a Jewish woman who lost her life in the pre-war concentration camps. So this tells you something about treatment, of course. We know of suicide attempts of Jewish women in the concentration camps, but there was, to the best of our knowledge, not a case of death, which is very different from the much more brutal and lethal treatment of men in the camps. Also, we see that the SS, who, as I said, assumes control of the concentration camps in the summer of 1934, is a bit slower in taking control of female confinement. Until 1937-38, most female prisoners, Jewish and non-Jewish, are held in a place called Moringen in Lower Saxony today. And this camp simultaneously functions as a workhouse. So you'll have concentration camp inmates living next to workhouse inmates, and it is under a civilian authority, a civilian director who is not a member of the SS, that women are kept. And it changes only in 38, really, when a new camp, Lichtenburg, is opened for female prisoners, that the SS takes control. But this issue of separate housing, for example, that I've mentioned for male prisoners also takes effect for female prisoners. Jewish women are gradually isolated from non-Jewish female prisoners and are housed in a separate unit. So we'll see similarities and differences.
Right. How does this renewed look at the pre-war concentration camps change the way we think about the unfolding of the Holocaust?
I think it sensitizes us maybe in a way for discrimination starting very early on in the midst of German society. We can probably think about a broader range of perpetrators. I haven't talked about that until now, but what I also discovered is that members of the general public, and this might be neighbors, this might be business partners, might even be former friends and lovers, are responsible for landing Jews in concentration camp custody. And again, the motives for that vary from maybe having an economic profit to taking personal revenge and all that sort of motives. So I think it can enlarge our perception of who was actually responsible for working towards what I call the Jewish enemy category, and for taking on these opportunities offered by the Nazi regime, maybe to enrich oneself in order and thereby getting rid of a Jewish neighbor.
You talked a little bit about, not looking backwards, but rather going forward, looking at the social realities of German Jewish history. How did you get interested in this 1933 to 1939 period?
I started researching the concentration camp while I was working for the Berlin Holocaust Memorial. And for those of you listeners who have visited the memorial, it has an underground museum, a little information center, and there is a room of sites, which is a room that exhibits and documents the various localities of persecution and destruction of the Jews of Europe. It's about ghettos, transit camps, death camps, sites of mass killings, deportation routes, but also about concentration camps. And we worked a lot with photographic images in order to represent those sites of persecution and destruction. And it struck me that when we talk about the pre-war concentration camp, these places were not somewhere far away in the east, as so many people would think. But as I said, they were right in the midst of German society. So they must have been very visible, probably even very audible places. And this whole narrative, of course, of we didn't know what was going on in the East, collapses very much when we look at the pre-war period. So I felt that I needed to investigate that further. And when the research project at the University of London came up that decided to look specifically at the pre-war years, I was very much drawn to that.
Well, Kim, we've taken up a lot of your time, so any parting thoughts you'd like to share, and what are you working on next?
I thought about maybe the impact of this topic or how it can change the way that we not only perceive history, but also perceive our own times. And I think, as I said, becoming aware of what appears to be a harmless-looking period in the history of the persecution of Jews is actually a very violent one, can increase our awareness of discrimination happening in a society. It's not necessarily a society at war, but it's a peacetime society. And the use of police state methods, as I said, the declaration of an emergency state and all that can come with it probably help us also to see our own times more critically. And my new project, if I may say quickly, is on the history of enemy aliens in the Second World War, focusing on Britain and Nazi Germany. Probably most of your listeners' first association is the Japanese-American internment in World War II. But there isn't much work done yet on what happens in Europe, and I want to investigate the treatment of foreign civilians in Britain and in Nazi Germany, compare that. And again, many of those categorized enemy aliens in in the UK were, of course, Jewish refugees fleeing from Nazi persecution. So I want to look at notions of citizenship, race, national belonging, and hopefully also at the history of international law aiming at the humanitarian protection of these civilians.
Kim, that sounds like a great project. I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
The book is Before Auschwitz, Jewish Prisoners in the Pre-War Concentration Camps, published this year by Harvard University Press. The author is Kim Wunschmann. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.